Hi everyone, and welcome to our second InReg podcast of 2025. My name is Ina Sala. I'm a partner in the Dentons Regulatory and Investigations team. I'm joined by my fellow partner, Laura Seaborn, and legal counsel based in Scotland, Laura Murphy. If you haven't listened already, our first episode touched on the top five issues in the contentious reg world for 2025 and is available for download. This covered five reg issues and trends to watch out for this year, and the link is available on the Dentons website, Spotify, and our LinkedIn pages. Today, though, we'll be discussing the topic of independence and investigations. This will start with some context on why investigations are increasing, why independence is so fundamental, what we mean when we say independent, and a brief canter through relevant legislation and guidance, including from a global perspective, before concluding with some real life, high profile examples. Let's get started by exploring the fact that investigations, including internal investigations, have become increasingly common. And I thought we could touch on some of the reasons why. Laura, I wonder whether we sort of start with you, and what do you think, given your in-house perspective?
Well, firstly, I would say we have seen heightened scrutiny by law enforcement agencies worldwide, which it would appear are increasingly looking to hold firms and individuals to account for their actions.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got some statistics to support that. So starting with the FCA, in data taken from their consultation on increasing transparency of enforcement investigations, and that was at the end of November last year, the FCA advised that they had 147 open enforcement operations. They've acknowledged that they've raised the bar for opening an investigation and strengthened the pre-investigation triage process to consider whether an investigation is most likely to drive impactful deterrence across the industry. So that might mean that we see a plateauing in number from the FCA.
But meanwhile, the Serious Fraud Office has ramped up its efforts recently. I think we were all acutely aware of the impact of the leadership of Nick F. Grave when he joined as director, which resulted in, I think, more Dawn raids in his first 6 months of tenure than the previous 2 years combined. And actually, more recently, the SFO took action at the Crown Court to seek to enforce the terms of a deferred prosecution agreement that they allege has been breached. And actually, just in the last few days of recording this podcast, actually, that court action has been confirmed as allowed to proceed.
And the SFO and FCA are not on their own here in the UK. You've also got the head of OFSI, who obviously oversee the sanctions regime last year, saying that he expects a broader range of cases with higher values coming out in this year. And there are similar themes across the pond. For example, last year, the US Securities and Exchange Commission has been equally proactive. And while there were less cases, their enforcement outcomes in particular were more significant. It obtained orders for $8.2 billion in financial remedies, I believe, last year, which amounts to the highest in SEC history. And so it will be interesting to see if that continues, particularly in the Trump era.
So it does look like the global landscape is shifting, with regulatory bodies determined to ensure compliance and accountability, and quite possibly that's supported with greater public interest and backing for those actions.
Yeah, I also think the legal environment is becoming more complex, and that is playing a part in the increased focus on investigations. So it's not just sort of the regulatory landscape, but also new legislation introducing an arguably greater legal risk for organisations. So a real live example of it at the moment is we've got the failure to prevent fraud offence under the Economic Crime and Corporate Transparency Act coming into force in September this year, with lots of people scrabbling around trying to prepare for that.
Yes, and also there is a new duty to prevent sexual harassment in the workplace under the Worker Protection Act, which came into force in October last year.
Yeah, and we've also seen enhanced whistleblowing requirements come into play.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're seeing this totally track through the work we're currently doing. Taking the example Laura gave around the duty to prevent sexual harassment, we've observed an increase in non-financial misconduct cases. The FCA has echoed that, recently reporting a significant increase in non-financial misconduct cases between 2001 and 2023, particularly in the wholesale banks portfolio, which has seen the highest reported incidence of those kinds of cases. So there we're talking about bullying on the one side, sexual harassment potentially on the other. And this uptick can coincide with a new proactive duty that Laura mentioned to take reasonable steps to prevent sexual harassment.
Yeah, so I think fundamentally, with more regulatory and indeed legal duties imposed on employers, I do think we could potentially see a surge in reports that require to be investigated.
Yeah, absolutely. It's about sort of mitigating that wider legal risk, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, I'd add that individual accountability is becoming increasingly important. Not only have we seen the impact of the so-called court of public opinion, some examples of which we'll come onto later, but also individual accountability as a result of regulation.
Yeah, so in terms of the regulation piece, we've obviously got the senior managers and certification regime, the SMCR, in the UK, which has, you know, as Laura said, enhanced individual accountability within financial services firms. And 2 years ago now, Ireland introduced a similar framework called the Individual Accountability Framework, or IFA, which again is aimed at enhancing individual accountability within the financial services sector. But nevertheless, at present, for all those reasons, it's easy to see why an increase in investigations is not surprising.
Absolutely. And speaking with former industry experience, these really are a big deal for organisations, and for a few reasons really. For some, depending on the size of the firm and the size of the investigation, they can significantly affect the bottom line. Clearly, they are an essential aspect of mitigation, whether it be from legal, regulatory, reputational, or even employment-related risk. And then, of course, sometimes the investigation itself is legally required to comply with certain obligations. Mandatory reporting might be required. In certain circumstances, market announcements need to be considered. And so, quite apart from being a requirement, they can also play a useful role in improving internal procedures and processes. So they are important and they are a big deal.
So for those organisations that are facing or conducting their own investigation, where should their focus lie?
Oh, that's a big question. And I think ultimately depends on each individual case. But fundamentally, for an investigation, in my view, to be effective, it must be and be perceived to be thorough, fair and importantly independent. And these concepts are very much interlinked.
And in this podcast today, we are going to focus on that aspect, independence in investigations. But I think it would be remiss not to acknowledge that there are a great many other considerations and risks to keep in mind. So, for example, privilege, setting up the correct investigation team, what reporting is required. You might have potentially cross-jurisdictional issues, especially when large global businesses are concerned.
Yeah, it's a lot to think about. If we come back to today's focus, so the independence of investigations, it is so fundamental to the integrity of an investigation that, ironically, it can sometimes be overshadowed by other louder competing priorities when setting things up.
Absolutely. Such as urgency, for example, whether that's perceived or actual, there's always a desire to get the investigation started as soon as possible to ascertain what's happened, what the next step should be, particularly when there is the potential for external reporting obligations or external interests. Finding a resolution for stakeholders or the subject of the investigation becomes a real high priority. Other factors such as expertise or trust in those contexts are sometimes given greater weight than independence. And whilst these are also undeniably essential factors, they shouldn't be at the expense of independence. In our experience, we've seen costs and time pressures weigh into considerations of proportionality of the investigation as well. So it's there's definitely lots of competing factors.
And again, you know, speaking from industry experience, for firms in these pressurised environments, it is natural to turn to trusted advisors that you know and they know you. But equally, it's crucial to consider who the ultimate audience is and the purpose of the investigation, to really ensure that independence isn't compromised.
Yeah, finding an investigator who is not only independent but also has the relevant expertise, I think, can be challenging. So ideally you want someone who has experience of dealing with clients in the relevant industry or in the relevant topic of the investigation. I think the value of institutional knowledge of the firm itself also shouldn't be underestimated. So having experience with an organisation can improve efficiency and effectiveness. I know in previous investigations that we've conducted, for example, we might be appointed by a group company rather than the company under investigation. So they're sufficiently distant from the individuals involved, but also able to help push the investigation along by, for example, collating information in response to regulators' information requests.
Yeah, it's also crucial that whoever's conducting the investigation, you know, quite rightly, is trusted by the company, whilst also being independent and fair. Internal investigations often deal with extremely sensitive topics, involve senior individuals, and so that becomes increasingly more acute in those types of circumstances.
Mm-hmm. It absolutely does, and obviously those investigations require quite detailed disclosure of personal matters that could go on to significantly impact people's personal lives and also their livelihoods. You know, if you're talking about a senior manager under the senior manager regime, a finding that someone is not fit and proper could mean that they are in the future unlikely to be employed at another financial services firm. So the ramifications are wide-reaching.
And then there's the question of perception of independence. And I think the rise in media scrutiny, what some people might call trial by media, there's a debate about whether there's an overemphasis on achieving complete independence, if we can call it that, potentially at the expense of getting the investigation done efficiently or in the most effective way.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And whilst the balance between independence and efficiency is challenging, the potential consequences of neglecting independence can be far-reaching, affecting not just the investigation itself, but also the reputations and professions of those involved. So against that background, why might an organisation choose to have someone independent investigate when a significant compliance issue has arisen?
Well, I mean, as a starter, it avoids conflicts of interest. Clearly, an investigation should be conducted without any self-serving interest, and a lack of conflicted parties reduces the chances of undue influence, but also the risk of challenging the findings of an investigation at a later point. Another point of conflict to think about is whether the investigator, for example, an external law firm, has a long-standing relationship with a CEO or CFO from past instructions. So if that's the case, it might be that another person from the law firm acting at arm's length would be more appropriate to run the investigation rather than the individual who usually deals with the firm. Likewise, if counsel has conducted previous investigations or advised the compliance team, that's unlikely to create an independence issue as long as the effectiveness of the compliance team isn't the live issue.
Yeah, I agree entirely with that. And I think I would also add that having an independent investigator also leads to greater objectivity, or at least it increases the chance that the investigation will find the truth, or at least an analysis which is objective and as unbiased as possible. As the saying goes, knowledge is power, and you can only truly mitigate and prevent the risks that you know about. So investigations, I think, offer valuable insight into the reality of a situation for an organisation. And in real terms, that knowledge can then be used in assessing properly litigation risk, managing, controlling, predicting public scrutiny. And I suppose, thinking positively, some true learnings from a situation and growing from that. And I think it can also inform what action an organisation should take in relation to their obligations in terms of regulatory and compliance. Notably, last year, the PRA actually announced a 50% discount on fines for companies that make early admissions and show full candour on their probes. So, for example, handing over reports and interview transcripts. So, again, just that having the knowledge, you can use it to your advantage, and there can even be a financial, even incentive to do so.
I suppose we've talked about conflicts and objectivity, but I think having a level of independence when conducting an investigation also enhances the credibility of the output. It can help to build trust among, you know, various different stakeholders, whether that's the employees you're speaking to, shareholders, customers, clients, and in some circumstances, sort of even the public. Given that internal investigations are sometimes used as a response to a public scandal, a true commitment to transparency and ethical practices can be crucial in maintaining and recovering a company's reputation. Regulators have also been known to criticise investigations carried out for firms that have essentially, in their mind, whitewashed the issues and engineered it to provide favourable findings. I have certainly experienced some regulators questioning, at the very least, whether an investigation that was conducted, albeit not by us, but by someone else, was truly independent. And we often see that type of criticism in investigations into specific topics. And one example might be this ever-growing concern around non-financial misconduct.
Absolutely. And it's worth noting that the discussion around independence of investigations isn't limited to the UK. It's a topic of interest in other jurisdictions as well. So I think there's increasing focus in France and in the US on how this issue is handled, although perhaps that's a topic for another day.
Yeah, absolutely. We've talked, haven't we, about why it's so important and what benefits independence can give. And I think it's really been recognised not just by industry, but also by our own regulators. So I wonder if we might touch on the role of lawyers in investigations, and in particularly in light of the guidance given by the Solicitors Regulation Authority that was issued last year.
Yeah, we could do a recap on that. So in March last year, the SRA, the Solicitors Regulatory Authority, published guidance for internal investigations. And that was then refined following feedback and published in November last year. And this guidance is for all SRA regulated firms and their lawyers. The SRA recognises in the guidance that the process of instigating or conducting an investigation might actually be handled by an organisation that they themselves don't regulate. However, the guidance is directed towards solicitors and law firms when they are involved in leading or conducting an internal investigation. So that could apply when you're working in-house, for example, or when a law firm is conducting an investigation on its own behalf. And so they acknowledge that this guidance might be informative for solicitors and firms conducting both law firms, but also other organisations.
And fundamentally, the guidance re-emphasises that if an investigation isn't sufficiently independent, it risks breaching a solicitor's regulatory obligations to act with independence, integrity, and in a way that upholds public trust, doesn't it?
That's exactly right. So I think with that in mind, it might be helpful to just briefly summarise some of the key points in this guidance.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to take that one. So as a starting point, and echoing some of what we discussed earlier about the competing priorities at the outset of the investigation, the guidance starts with setting up the terms of reference for the investigation and ensuring the scope, key stakeholders, timelines, sharing of information, and crucially, identifying the decision makers are set up and ideally documented from the outset.
And then, perhaps unsurprisingly, there's a large section about independence with the warning shot we've highlighted that if an investigation you're leading or conducting isn't sufficiently independent, it risks a breach of your regulatory obligations. The guidance factors to be taken into account in assessing that, such as how far removed they are from the alleged wrongdoing, prior knowledge, and guardrails such as information barriers, are all set out there.
And quite importantly, from working in-house previously, it specifically calls out the challenges that in-house lawyers will have to work through when they're involved in investigations. And one of the key ones being confident that you can be objective. And that, for example, you won't later be asked to give legal advice on matters related to the internal investigation. And for smaller organisations with quite small in-house teams, that could be particularly challenging. And I think that's when actually having this SRA guidance committed to in writing, it's a regulatory obligation, might be helpful to support the in-house lawyer community and their discussions with their business when investigations are being set up, just to make sure that their role is clear.
Yeah, it's a really important perspective. Thanks, Laura. And of course, it does also acknowledge that instructing someone external, like a law firm, might be appropriate in some circumstances, which, you know, as you've said, we see all the time.
Yeah, it does. And not least for all the reasons we've discussed before, but also because the guidance then acknowledges that being involved in an investigation can be difficult for all concerned.
It does, and that's obviously true. And for that reason, the guidance highlights the need for additional support, particularly for whistleblowers. So ensuring their anonymity and protection from victimisation is crucial. And I think something that's close to my heart, it's also very important to make reasonable adjustments for interviewees and also for interviewers, because they should be adequately trained in fairness and how to ask appropriate questions. I think given some of the issues that investigations touch on, I think there's an increasing expectation that investigators, whilst independent, should also be trauma-informed and handle these issues with sensitivity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's particularly important as we've seen the breadth of subject matter being investigated becoming wider. We might also consider offering independent legal advice for individuals. So offering individuals lawyers that aren't involved in the investigation in itself. And it might well be necessary. And particularly, I'm thinking where there could be potential adverse consequences, such as, for example, in the financial services sector, impacts on senior managers.
Yeah, absolutely. And ensuring that all parties have access to appropriate support and representation helps to maintain the integrity of the investigation, ultimately.
It does, and just really protects all those involved in an investigation. And I think just fundamentally, it's the right thing to do. And it's certainly something that I always have an eye on when working in these high-pressured situations.
Yeah. The next strand, if I may, of the guidance is all about recording evidence. And the guidance notes that preserving available evidence as soon as possible is crucial to avoid the loss of memories and people leaving the organisation, as well as having technical support for saving and recovering electronic files, communications. And of course, as most litigators amongst us will know, preserving metadata. So there is data when documents were created or deleted. And the other thing I think to touch on is the use of personal devices more and more. And I think that's perhaps a topic for another podcast, but it's definitely something that we're seeing people grappling with at the moment.
The use of personal devices and metadata, my favourite topic. I think that's for me when organisations need to ideally have a really good playbook that's been prepared in advance of a crisis event. Those come into their own when dealing with high-pressured situations, because these can cover all sorts of considerations in a fully thought-out and planned way, even rehearsed way. And I know that those on this podcast have been involved in sort of practice runs of these sorts of events. And I think that's really crucial for organisations to take time in advance of an event to make these preparations.
Yeah, I think that's right. And then the guidance goes on to consider concluding an investigation, how to report the output, and where applicable, if the SRA needs to be informed.
Yeah, and on that point, just in our experience, there's in some cases merit in reporting the facts only and keeping the remediation actions and sanctions separate. Particularly where you're considering issues of legal professional privilege. So it's really important to make sure that you know what your output is going to be as well.
Yeah, that's a really good tip. And I think, again, for the in-house community, very important to be thinking about. And again, just leading on, while the SRA guidance is, of course, focused on reporting to it, I think I'd also flag for organisations to consider whether there are other regulatory or even market reports required following the output of an investigation.
Right, definitely. So it's a lot to think about, even at the end of an investigation. And there are various touch points where external input, such as from an external law firm, can be appropriate, even if the investigation itself is handled internally. So I wonder if we might finish today with lessons learned and considerations to take from some high-profile cases that have faced a bit of criticism, to sort of bring to life the importance of independence in investigations. On a no-names basis, of course, this isn't name and shame.
Much to the FCA's disappointment. One lesson that may be surprising is the question of whether to maintain confidentiality in the investigation, who the investigator is and what their conclusions are. There've certainly been examples where, for example, external barristers have been appointed to assist in an internal investigation, even where that investigation pertains to matters of a personal nature, for example, alleged inappropriate controlling behaviour between staff members of different seniority. And in these circumstances, would we expect to have the investigator named? and their conclusions published. In one instance, I can think of at least, we do have an example where a firm has refused to publish the outcome of the investigation or at least any significant details. But that resulted in them being accused of being insufficiently independent.
Yeah, and that's really interesting because to what extent do the public and indeed the media have a right to this level of information? I suppose for regulated or publicly listed companies, they do perhaps to a certain extent, but it is certainly an interesting tension. Another lesson or consideration to think about from real life examples, and perhaps this one isn't actually so surprising, but it can certainly from experience be difficult to achieve in practice, is who should actually be involved in an investigation within a firm. This is so fundamental to the principle of independence, as we've discussed. So clearly the investigator cannot themselves be under investigation. And this obviously sounds trite, it's so obvious, but at certain firms or in certain circumstances, it can actually be quite difficult to achieve. And that's maybe because the allegations involve the most senior C-suite, or again, from in-house perspective, for GCs, they may have given legal advice that's then relied on. There's then an investigation surrounding the fact of those circumstances. So it's definitely something for those involved in advising and investigations to keep under consideration, and actually to keep under consideration throughout the investigation.
Yeah, it can be really tricky. And finally, just a word of caution, I think, for those lawyers advising investigations, even where external lawyers are appointed, and even if they are named, public criticism can still ensue with accusations of a whitewash.
Yeah, it's certainly a difficult tightrope to walk. I mean, I think fundamentally these examples emphasise the importance of ensuring genuine independence in investigations. To maintain integrity in the public trust and credibility, but actually not just the public, for those internal to the organisation as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. We can probably talk about this topic forever and ever and ever, but I think we should bring it to a close. We hope you found this very insightful. We've explored the complexities and challenges involved in maintaining independence, from balancing that independent tightrope with other priorities, and the challenges brought by the court of public opinion, as it were, and as well as ensuring compliance and regulatory requirements.
Absolutely. And if you'd like any advice on the topics raised today, please don't hesitate to contact someone from the Dentons team.
And finally, please look out for future episodes of the InReg podcast from the Dentons Regulatory and Investigations team in 2025. Thank you for joining us today, and feedback, not just from our families, is most welcome.